Capitol Report is a production of Senate Media Services.
It was budget forecast week at the Capitol, with officials projecting a $17.5 billion surplus. This week, Governor Tim Walz and legislative leaders react. Budget officials provide detail and context, and both the GOP and DFL begin outlining priorities. Stay tuned for this week's Capitol Report. Welcome to this week's program. I'm Shannon Lurkey. State budget officials announced that Minnesota's economic outlook appears to be stable. Despite the inclusion of inflationary calculations due to a new law, the state continues to have a projected $17.5 billion budget surplus. And now it's time for lawmakers to craft the state's next two-year budget. Governor Walz and legislative leaders responded to the news.
Minnesota is strong in so many areas, but there's a vulnerability in an aging population in a northern tier state with high personal incomes. All of those things require us to strategize. How do we make this a welcoming state? How do we make sure, and we say welcoming, that's everyone that's here. How do we make sure we continue to reduce the cost for people to decide to have children and go back into the workforce? And how do we make sure our education system is providing the skill sets necessary for people to be able to participate across? We think all of those things in this budget is exactly what it's going to take.
We've been coasting for far too long on past educational rankings, and we're falling behind. Thousands of Minnesotans struggle with the cost of health insurance premiums and copays that they can barely afford, poor coverage, and in some cases, unaffordable prescription drugs. Every day, there are Minnesotans who find it hard to make ends meet, struggling with the rising cost of childcare, housing, and other necessities. House DFLers will focus on reducing costs to help Minnesotans enter and stay in the workforce, like job training, education, child care assistance, and paid time off to care for our loved ones when we need it. We are going to prioritize Minnesotans who are working hard every day to afford their lives.
We are united in continuing our work to improve the lives of Minnesotans. This new and final forecast for the session will inform our work, but it will not change our values and our priorities. When we are done, Minnesotans will see stronger schools that help students, safer communities, a cleaner climate, more freedom and expanded rights, and stability in their lives with more money in their pockets through targeted tax relief.
So where do those dollars come from? That's coming from Minnesota taxpayers, businesses, individuals that are moving forward in this state and really seeing the burden of tax impact their bottom line in their pocket. You know, Republicans have controlled in one body or another for the last 6 years one of the legislative bodies. We've really put an emphasis on how do we ensure that Minnesota families can afford to live in this state. It has been the forefront of our priorities, and really this is the fruit of the work that we have done, not only investing in state government and education and in communities, but also trying to reduce taxes for the middle class, trying to make sure that elderly are not getting taxed on their Social Security income. These are the things that we really put forward as priorities.
Jim Showalter is the commissioner of Minnesota's budgeting agency, and he joins me now to provide more details about the budget forecast. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
I always like to start with the picture on the cover of the forecast book. This year, it's two classic cross-country skiers forging straight ahead on a groomed path in pristine conditions. Does that sum up the view of the state's budget situation?
No, but probably the first thing that everyone should know is we were drawn to the picture because there was a lot of snow. You know, we were preparing the forecast. We were being, you know, watching all the warnings of snowstorms, and so it seemed appropriate to have a lot of snow on the cover of this particular forecast. I would actually say that there's a couple of things that are parallel. One is that, you know, it's steady as she goes. It's like, you know, it's a flat terrain. That's kind of what we're seeing right now, that this forecast is pretty similar to what we had anticipated in the last forecast. In addition, you know, looking forward into the next couple of years, it's like things are at a fairly steady kind of pace. But I would actually say that where we're at the beginning of a biennium with the legislature set to figure out the path of the next couple of years, it's more like, is it this trail or do we go over this trail? There's all kinds of different directions that we could still go.
So we can't see over the horizon, and there's a lot of options.
Yeah, that's right.
So the projected surplus, as you just mentioned, now is about the same as it was in the November forecast. The difference being the February number has included an inflation calculation thanks to a new law that was passed just last week. Republicans argue that calculating inflation on the spending side automatically grows the size of government. What's your view on that?
I disagree, but I understand the argument. And either way, I think the important function of the forecast is to get everyone the information about what's going on in the economy, what's happening, how that impacts state revenues and spending, and pulling it all together so that everyone can orient where they're at. Fighting over what the number is less important to me than the process of getting everyone oriented to where we're at, what are the risks, what are the challenges, what are the opportunities. And that is where we go. So as far as autopilot, I think one of the things that's not well understood is that the forecast already had some inflation in it on the expenditure side. So I didn't hear that being auto spending. It was just that there's some programs that already have adjustments, whether it's in long-term care or other areas where there's already adjustments in place. So this is really just to say we're not favoring some parts of the budget over others. We're trying to give you a set of numbers that has expenditures all sort of prepared in the same way, compared with revenues that are actually compared in a similar way, all for the impact of inflation.
You also said at the forecast that you expect revenues to exceed projected spending throughout the forecast horizon, and that the balance remaining in those projections is about $5 billion for each of the next two biennia. So that $5 billion is called a structural balance. Is that the same as the budget reserve, or is this different? What does that $5 billion structural balance mean?
It's a great question, and it's amazing that you and everyone continue to go to our forecast, because there's so many kind of inside language. I want to just sort of define a couple of them. One is sort of one-time money, which is money that was collected in previous years or previous biennia, and it's rolling forward. It's not recurring. It's something that was left over from prior years. Structural balance is like money in and money out in this year or in this biennium. And when I said there was $5 billion in structural money, it meant that in that biennium, in that two-year period of 24-25, that we were expecting to collect about more than $5 billion more than we were expecting to spend. So that's basically an opportunity for the governor and the legislature to change the law, whether it's to reduce taxes, reduce spending, increase spending, to adjust given that orientation of where we're at.
So lawmakers and the governor will decide how that $5 billion should be used going forward. But additionally, then, we are still left with $12.5 billion that is truly one-time money that could be used maybe to start a paid family medical leave program, the upfront costs for that, or refunds to taxpayers even above and beyond tax cuts, or perhaps a bonding bill. Do I have that right?
Yeah, that's right. There's that one-time money, that carry forward is most appropriately used for one-time purposes, because once you spent it, once you spend that $12 billion, it's gone. You won't get to spend it again in the third or fourth year or the fifth year of the future budget forecast. So those are some one-time things that really change policy, help people, and move the dial on how our communities work and the success of Minnesotans. There's a lot of those ideas out there. They're great. And that's going to be part of the debate. I think the challenge is always, that's a lot of one-time money. And so how do we use it constructively and smartly so that we don't create obligations going into the future and also have maximum impact so that we're not just spending it because we can, but we're actually really thoughtfully, carefully making sure that we have really big impact in our communities.
Is it conceivable that the legislature could discern such an important decision in you know, a session is sometimes feels long, but sometimes goes in the blink of an eye?
It does. It's fast. But, you know, we have a lot of smart people, a lot of ideas floating around, and that's where the debate comes in. It's a great thing, and it's messy. But I think, you know, that's the challenge. And with this forecast, you know, the information's out there, and we'll be putting together some new governor's recommendations, putting those on the table in a couple of weeks. That'll provide at least one set of tracks for people to follow going into the future. But then the House and Senate both will make their own decisions, and we'll see where we go.
I mentioned a bonding bill just a moment ago, and a budget session is typically not a bonding session, but there does seem to be a lot of interest in a bonding bill this year, maybe even two bonding bills this year. How much can the state responsibly borrow for a traditional bonding bill, or should the state not borrow and use the surplus or a combination of both? What are your thoughts on that?
I love that question, and we actually got that question in a cold day when we released the last capital budget about a year ago. And it was, you know, the budget was already anticipating a surplus, and it was like, why would you go borrow? And the answer is a couple things. One is, it's a program. You know, it is an ongoing set of investments by Minnesota in the infrastructure and communities of the state that shouldn't be just driven if we have good budget times or bad budget times. And that bonding element is part of that. The other thing is, because of the bonds, it's a long-term investment with multi-year payout. It helps us also just make sure we're putting it into things that have multi-year benefit, so that the benefits to people in year 5, 10, or 30 are also paid by people in years 5, 10, and 30, so that we don't underinvest in the things that make our communities vibrant. So, yeah, we can put cash into it, absolutely. We, in fact, in the governor's recommendation, went up to the limit. It was around $2.2 billion is like the debt threshold based upon our guidelines and this, based on this forecast. But because there was no bill last year, you know, the costs of the proposal got a lot more expensive, and so we had to put in cash just to, in order to afford the same proposals. It's almost 20% more. So, you know, you think about cost of delay or hidden charges, the inability to pass a capital bill last year, you know, it passed on a multi-hundred-million-dollar charge to everyone just to do the same things.
So, more to come on the bonding. As always, Commissioner Showalter, it's a pleasure. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Senate and House Republicans called a press conference to propose a plan to give back $13 billion of the surplus in tax relief.
So this is a historic moment in Minnesota, an opportunity to really reform our policies, our fiscal policies in this state, to begin partnering with Minnesotans again to help create an opportunity in this state to get that money back to Minnesotans. So we've come up with four different ideas here to help Minnesota. That's eliminating Social Security tax, that's permanent ongoing income tax relief, that's property tax relief for Minnesotans, and that's one-time relief for Minnesotans in the form of getting money back to them in a one-time check.
Ending that tax on Social Security, giving that relief, was something that both parties campaigned on, and that is something that could be a priority. We should have already gotten this done.
I'm carrying a bill in the Senate that would raise the residential homestead exemption, the ag homestead, and resort homestead exemption. Quite frankly, people's homes, their residential properties, become one of their greatest assets. And with the increase that we've had in values in Minnesota, and the increase in property taxes, we're starting to see many people being taxed out of their most important asset.
We talk to seniors every day who are struggling to pay their bills. Fixed incomes, and yet eggs are over $5 a dozen. Heating costs are up 30%. And so I am calling on the new majorities in the Senate and the House to be sure and get this much needed Social Security relief out the door as soon as possible.
The Minnesota legislature is in a budget setting session, and budget officials have released the February state budget and economic forecast, providing a snapshot of the state's economic health. State economist Laura Kalamakidis joins me now to talk about the current state of Minnesota's economy. Welcome.
Thank you.
So there's a fair amount of hand-wringing lately about the state of the United States economy, and economists have been all over the board talking about tailwinds and headwinds and soft landings and other recessionary concerns. Which trends do you find most meaningful when trying to read the economic crystal ball?
Yeah, this is a really interesting time where We're in a situation where good news is bad news on the U.S. macroeconomic front, where when the economy comes, when economic data come in hot, so to speak, for instance, labor market being stronger, more jobs than expected, more consumer spending than expected, that can feel like good news on one side, but bad news in the sense that that means the Fed is going to try to raise interest rates further or keep them higher longer to try to slow the economy. So it's very hard to know when the news comes in whether it's good or bad. So I'm eager to watch things like how the job market is growing and whether it's growing at a pace that is sustainable. Or is it growing so fast that wages are going to go up faster, and that's going to push up inflation, which causes the Fed to raise interest rates? So, trying to look for that Goldilocks economy, that it's not too fast, not too slow, but sort of just right.
Everything is just right. So we're going to talk about some of those elements that you just mentioned there. We're going to try to break it down. Before we do, IHS Markit, the state's macro consultant, in the November forecast predicted a deeper and longer recession than they do now in this forecast, the February. They're calling this recession, quote, mild by historical standards, with a recovery that could begin as early as the third quarter of this year. What's changed to make them more optimistic for the state of Minnesota?
Yes, some of the U.S. macro data that has come in since November has helped make them a little more optimistic. So job growth came in stronger than they expected. Consumer spending came in stronger than they expected, and inflation, importantly, came in lower. So prices are still rising, but they're rising at a lower pace, and that helped them come to the conclusion that maybe the Fed would not have to act more aggressively, and that maybe this downturn that they still do expect will be shorter and start later than what they had thought before.
At the presentation, you talked about the recession as an investment-driven recession because consumer spending remains strong. You said that business investments would decline, and you used the residential construction sector as an example. And it made me think of the 2008 recession and what that did to Minnesota's housing stock, and the fact that now we're reaping that in terms of a lack of affordable housing, a lack of homes for people. Is the state's housing shortage potentially going to worse if that same thing is kind of happening right now, where builders are slower to build?
Yeah, I think that might be possible. It may be too early to know yet, but the way this mechanism works is that this is forecast to be, as you said, an investment-driven recession, because it's going to affect those interest rate-sensitive sectors. So the places where it matters how high interest rates are, and mortgage interest rates having risen, that has affected residential housing. It's affected home sales, and it's affected new construction. And so right now, there appears to be quite a lot of construction in the pipeline. So that's continuing to persist. But if it goes on for a long time, that can affect whether new orders for new homes are put in, and perhaps that could affect the supply.
As I mentioned, consumer spending remains strong, but savings are down from the high that was achieved during the pandemic, which means that consumers are drawing down their savings or using credit to continue to make purchases. Is this concerning?
So, yeah, what happened was during the post, right after the pandemic, right at the beginning of the pandemic, the federal government, sent people stimulus checks and pandemic unemployment benefits, and the savings rate went extraordinarily high. So people saved a lot of that money, and they've been drawing it down since then. And so it's not a concern at the moment because some of that savings still exists. They haven't drawn it completely down yet. What I think the bigger concern is that it's been had differential effects across different kinds of people. So low-income people have drawn down that savings, and so they're the ones that are turning to consumer credit. Where the savings still exists, it's in high-income households, and their consumer spending is continuing to grow. And so that it's a concern for the low-income households who have drawn down their savings, who have turned to credit, and who are faced with inflation. And so everything they need to buy, especially housing, is more expensive.
A tight labor market is potentially good for workers, allowing them to change jobs, potentially increase their wages. Does this factor, though, ultimately impact inflation, because then from the business point of view, the cost of doing business is higher because the human capital is costing more?
Yes, it certainly can, and that's the concern of, you know, how can we bring inflation down? That one of the expectations right now is that with a forecast recession, that aggregate demand is going to go down, that's going to reduce the demand for labor, that's going to reduce this wage pressure. So the unemployment rate goes up and wage pressure comes down, and that helps soften inflation. The tight labor market and wage growth affects inflation depends on what kinds of jobs, because right now a lot of the wage growth has been in low-wage jobs, because these are the jobs that were affected, service jobs, for instance, the ones that were affected by restrictions from the pandemic, and jobs that are affected by increases in the minimum wage. And so that's where some of the inflation is coming right now.
Let's talk about the labor market just briefly. The report states, quote, a recovery in labor force participation, perhaps from increased immigration, delayed retirements, or improved access to childcare, could support more robust job growth, because we do have a tight labor market.
Yeah.
How important is a robust labor force for economic growth? And when you consider that Minnesota has negative domestic migration, are these some of the key ways that Minnesota can improve its labor force?
Yes. So we, in our forecast, we right now have fairly slow employment growth in the forecast because our labor force growth is slow. And so right now, we're forecasting that the total amount of wages that are paid out stays fairly strong, even while employment growth is slow, and that's because we're expecting wages per worker to go up. So it makes sense. Everybody makes, you know, on average, people make more money. But that's a tenuous situation, and it could be relieved if we have a larger labor force. And so policies that can reduce barriers to work can help loosen that up. So is there childcare is one of the key ways, affordable housing, transportation, training. These are ways that we can potentially bring people into the labor force and increase labor supply.
A few risks to the accuracy of this forecast are monetary policy, and we've been talking about that, how the Federal Reserve handles interest rates, and the debt ceiling impasse. So two quick questions. One, how significantly does the Federal Reserve's decisions impact the state of Minnesota? And two, how would a default of the federal government on its debts by not raising the debt ceiling impact the state?
Yeah, so we are very much affected by what happens in monetary policy, because that affects interest rates, and so it affects those interest rate sectors here in the state of Minnesota. And also it affects the growth of the U.S. economy and whether the U.S. economy stays in an inflationary environment or goes into a recession or someplace in between. And we're tied to the U.S. economy, so that really does affect us. Regarding the debt ceiling, so we've never faced default completely. At the moment, we've bypassed the debt ceiling, and the Treasury is engaging in these extraordinary measures. When that runs out, then default could happen. We've never faced that, so we don't know exactly what's going to happen, but it will be really severely negative for the U.S. economy, and it depends on how long we're in that situation. So is it a short-term situation, or is it a longer-term situation? But the negative effects will mount, and we're likely to have a deep recession if that happens.
Dr. Laura Kalimbakidis, always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
As deadlines loom, lawmakers are rolling out proposals that would rely on funding from the $17.5 billion surplus. Recently, Senate and House DFLers called for free college tuition.
The program will be effective fall 2024, with nearly 59,000 students receiving an award. That includes 32,000 in Mid-State two-year colleges, 13,000 Minnesotans at our state 4 years, and 13,000 at the University of Minnesota institutions.
Tuition increases are not state revenue, they are a tax. And those declining enrollment numbers show that we have taxed that population to the max, and they're simply not going to take it anymore.
So this targeted investment
to low-income families will help level the playing field by removing tuition barriers and providing extra support to students in need.
We're at a breaking point here. We are at really a crisis in terms of enrollment. And if we do not do something to address this declining enrollment because of increased tuition costs, it's going to be to the point where we're going to have to start talking about which campuses are we going to close in the state.
This is a choice that we've made. The crisis that Senator Kupek and Representative Pawlowski were just talking about is a crisis of our own making. We have actively decided to disinvest in higher education in the past 30 years. And that means it is both our obligation and our opportunity to solve that problem.
Republicans urged the creation of a special revenue fund to improve student literacy.
Only half of Minnesota students can read at grade level. And I'm going to say that again, half. That's a tragedy.
The surplus provides us with a unique opportunity to reset our priorities and fix our approach to literacy with real investments in the science of reading, which are then real investments in our schools and in our students. This establishes a special revenue fund, not unlike a disaster relief fund, from which schools can apply to cover costs related to aligning their curriculum and instructional practices to the science of reading.
We know that there are people who have vested interests in keeping the system the same. And yet we are here today to say that we are drawing a line in the sand and that it is time for us to only invest in the science of reading.
This is not a Republican issue. It's not a Democrat issue. This is a Minnesota issue. This should be as bipartisan as it gets. And what we haven't seen so far this session is any priority being given to the critical literacy needs of our kids.
And DFLers advocated for a significant investment in affordable housing.
Housing is a foundation on which we all build our lives. A safe place to come home to at the end of a day of school or work. A place where we build memories, do homework, and spend time with our loved ones. Homes are where we care for our children and our parents, where we rest and heal, where we dream and plan. Without stable housing, everything else can fall apart. 25% of Minnesotans are paying at least 30% of their income for housing. And 22% of all renter households in Minnesota are paying 50% or more of their income. That's over 130,000 households. These numbers are unsustainable, and we have an opportunity to help close the gap.
This plan will end children and youth homelessness by 2030 in Minnesota. This is a big goal, but it's achievable. And we do so in large part by ensuring every low-income family with children has access to a state-based housing voucher. This is a game changer in our work to end childhood poverty, a goal that we share with Governor Walz.
Join us again next week as we delve into more topics affecting Minnesotans. I'm Shannon Lurkey, and on behalf of all of us at Senate Media Services, thanks for watching.